Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to Blog Talk Radio, Council of Elders Show. This is the beginning of 2021. We have a rousing show for you this morning. Please stand by for our host, Mr. Jason Brooks, and his special guest. He will introduce him. But now that we have gone through 2020, everybody is looking forward to a beautiful new 2021. Please hold on to something, because it's going to be a great show. Stand by for the Council of Elders show.
Good morning, everybody. My name is Jason Brooks, and I want to welcome and thank everybody for calling in to the Council of Elders talk show. And I also want to wish everybody a happy 2021. We've come through a very turbulent year, and thank God we made it. We have a interesting guest with us today, Dr. Sam McAlpine. But for you new listeners, let me explain the purpose of the Council of Elders concept. The purpose is for older people, elders, to give advice, counsel, and life experience to younger people. Advice that can help them navigate successfully through life, deal with issues, and avoid some of the pitfalls that can affect everyone. The concept is based historically on African culture, where elders in the community had council members to help guide and encourage tribe members, settle disputes, etc. Young people are especially invited to call in with questions or issues today. My dream is to have a Council of Elders group or organization in every community in America, and for the Council of Elders to be known about in the community so that people could have an opportunity to get advice from elders about their concerns. But it first starts with a single Council of Elders group, so we're establishing a group of elders here in the Sacramento, California area. I'd like to have about 10 volunteers. Once we get enough volunteers, we can go to youth centers, juvenile halls, boys and girls clubs, and churches, etc. We can also be available to young adults as well. Sometimes they need advice on how to raise kids, how to get along in their careers, their marriages, etc. Moving forward, this is an effort to bridge the gap between young people and elders. The younger generation today and the older generation should start to merge. The Council of Elders is an effort to do so. Well, we have an interesting guest with us today, Dr. Sam McAlpine. And Dr. McAlpine, welcome to the show.
Oh, thank you.
Yes, Dr. McAlpine, can you give us a little bit about your background?
Yeah, I'm now in my 70s. I was born and reared in rural West Alabama, south of the city of Tuscaloosa. For those of you who are familiar with that area, it is considered the Black Belt, and it is the Black Belt for two reasons. The soil is rich because of rivers and silt, and also the counties are heavily predominantly Black because of slavery. Most of the people who came there were brought as slaves in the early 1800s by primarily generals who were victorious in the wars of 1776 and 1812. And the people in this country felt that it should be rewarded, so they basically took Native American land, primarily West Alabama, was the Choctaws. I think the only remnant of them left in that area would be a reservation in Mississippi, and the rest of them who survived were driven into Oklahoma. Well, I grew up there on land that my daddy's side of the family had a pain during before Reconstruction. Well, it was around 1870. My great-great-grandfather had it. He bought his first 212 acres of land. He was a blacksmith, so that's how he made his livelihood post-emancipation. And we still have that original 212 acres, and several hundred acres have been added to it. But I grew up on that farm with my mother, dad, and my nine siblings. I was one of the older ones. I did go to undergraduate school at Alabama A&M because it was one of the few that I knew. I had cousins who had gone there and several older relatives. But I was the first person in my nuclear family to attend. I majored in biology, zoology, chemistry, and all those good things that I was interested in. And, of course, you know, this was the height of the Vietnam War. I was a freshman in 67, 68. And, Mr. Jansen, you've probably heard me say that to our alumni association, that I went through an inordinate amount of effort to try not to get drafted into Vietnam. One of my brothers, younger than me, had gone off. He decided that he wanted to work for a while. He had gone to Detroit with family members, went to General Motors. He was drafted and was already there. So I don't have to remind anybody what happened in that war. Well, anyway, we had this lady over the Federal Selective Service in Greene County who was determined to draft all black males. And she came after me. I got a letter that you're going to be drafted at the end of your semester because, you know, everybody goes on that summer hiatus. So I went to school year-round for 4 years and finally graduated September 71. But the interesting thing was there was a very illustrious woman who was my mentor at Alabama A&M said, you know, you have very good grades, seem to be pretty bright, take my car, go take the MCAT, which is a medical college admission test. And I went and took it at the University of North Alabama there, which used to be Florence State, passed it. And I was accepted at Meharry Medical College, who had not accepted a graduate of Alabama A&M in 40 years. And my tuition was paid the first 2 years by the National Medical Association, which most of you know is the historic Black Medical Association. But eventually I got married at the end of my sophomore year, so wife and I decided that I would get to the National Health Services Corps, so I got a public health scholarship, which gave me some tuition, and the rest is history. I fulfilled my 2 years of obligation to the public health service and did my internship at then under Tulane in New Orleans. Went to the public health service, did my residency in medicine at Arizona, and I got to USC for my fellowship in immunology and rheumatology, which is how I became familiar with California. And I have been here in Sacramento for about 20 years, and I just called myself retired from the VA out at Travis in December of last year.
Oh, okay.
That's
okay.
My history in a capsule.
Right, right. So, you know, I just like to go back a little bit to your early childhood in West Alabama, and some of the things that your mother and father taught you, Dr. McAlpine, that helped you out through your life. Can you give us a little bit of insight on that?
Well, probably two things stand out for me. You know that in the South, people have a lot of sayings, both population groups, but, you know, some people call them idioms, I-D-I-O-M-S. And my mother and father would always speak of two things that stood out to me, and now I'm an old guy now. They're both dead. My parents would always say, don't feed frogs for a snake. And we would always ask, well, what do you mean? If you feed the frog to the snake, you know, I guess talking about a person who's like a snake, they would still bite you. And, of course, we were scared to death considering that in Alabama or the South, you know, we have America's three poisonous snakes, the rattlesnake, the moccasin, and the coral. So that always stuck with me. And the other was, and this was a favorite one of my mother, was that in life she would always say, in order to keep us on the straight and narrow and not to make mistakes and get in with the wrong crowd, she would say, you'll have many acquaintances, but you'll have very few friends. Those are the two that I most remember, sir.
Oh, okay, okay. Well, I know my mother used to say that too, and my grandmother, feeding frogs for snakes, and I never understood that myself. It's funny you should mention that.
same culture.
Yeah, yes, indeed. So now I'd like to talk a little bit about the slavery. You know, you have a good knowledge of South Carolina and how the American slaves were distributed. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Well, fortunately for me, one of the people that I can most remember who knew quite a lot about it was my daddy's mother, who was born in 1889. I remember her. She died in 1967. My dad's father died rather early at age 51 from prostate cancer. I was only 2 years old, so I don't remember him. My mother's mother had died when my mother was 3 years old, so she was reared by her maternal grandparents, and they were sharecroppers, even when my dad married her. Now, my daddy's side of his family had people who were a little bit more adventuresome, and some of them went away to places like Hartford, New Brunswick, Canada, eventually ended in here in Los Angeles, one of them who went to the Hartford Conservatory and that kind of thing. So I learned a lot from them, enough to start compiling data on who these people were on my dad's side of the family that I know much more about than I know my mother's side of the family. And it has to do with the fact that there were people on my dad's side of the family who early on developed a little bit more literacy than I saw on my mother's side of the family. And one of the things that drove me to this, because I practiced in Phoenix, which had a, when I left USC in 1983, and it had a large Latter-day Saints or Mormon community. And, you know, they are into genealogy. And one of the things at that time is they have a massive building that has all these microfilms all the way back in terms of the census. And I had some names, and I wanted to find out where these people were from, their dates of birth, et cetera. It took me 30 days of going through microfilms at their genealogy center, and I found my dad's side of the family, the slaves whose property that we still own. His name was Adam Brute. His wife was named Chaney, C-H-A-N-E-Y, Brute. He was born in 1835. She was born in 1840. Both of them were born on a South Carolina slave plantation. And South Carolina, if you're a student of history, geographically sits right across the middle passage. And this slave, and my dad, who was born in 1919, he remembers Chaney. She didn't die until the late 1920s, and he remembers her as a child. And my dad's aunt remembers her quite well. She talked about places like Senegal and Goree Island. And, you know, it didn't make a lot of sense to me, but on the 1880 census, the significance of that for all of us as blacks, that is the first census in which every black American at that time was counted. There was a census in 1870, but you were not counted unless you were a land owner. So I got the 1880 census, and I saw, sure and whole, Sarah, Frank, Mary, and Ida. Those were the four children who are descendants of that, those two slaves. And I'm a descendant of Sarah. And that's how I got the name McAlpine, because Sarah's husband was Jeff McAlpine, who had a similar history. His family, South Carolina, but from Hale County, which you know is right across the Warrior River from Greene County. So the story of the family is he came across the Warrior River, and he was smitten with Sarah, and he married her, and he stayed on the family property, and they had three children. One of their children, Nebraska. That's my grandfather. My dad is dead. But what I thought about South Carolina is South Carolina now, there in Charleston, has a historical museum with a lot of slave remnants. I have belonged to Roots well. In fact, during some of the genealogy and what have you, I'm one of those people who participated in African ancestry DNA when they first perfected their database. And I was able to find a lot of things DNA-wise by doing DNA on certain people in the extended family to know that there was DNA from the Fulani in Senegal, from the Bamalikis in the Cameroon, my mother's people. I was able to do my mitochondrial DNA. Mitochondrial DNA you inherit from your mother, and it never changes for centuries, 500 generations or so. She was 100% Mende, and the Mendes are in Sierra Leone. I can tell you some famous people who genetically were Mende: King, Andrew Young, Maya Angelou. This kid who was off emergency room, I forget his name, but I know he was. But what I'm saying is there's a lot that you can do through DNA, much more than you can do with just the genealogy, because until 1870, we as a people, you listed on the slave rolls, and I've looked at the slave rolls in Greene County meticulously for years trying to figure out who brought my ancestors, both on my mother's side and my dad's side, into Greene County, Alabama, and Hale County, because Hale County and Greene County used to be the same county. But these generals, as they were victorious, you know, they had to have something named after them. In the early 1900s, they separated Greene County at the Warrior River on the east and the Tombigbee River on the west, and it became Greene County, and to the east was Hale County. So they used to be the same county. So a lot of history is in both of those counties. But I've also studied on a genealogy.com and a lot of other things trying to look at relatives. So I can tell you, those of you who are interested in genealogy, it can be very, very difficult, because the first full census rolls for us is 1880. Question.
1880 is, you say, is the first
full
records of African Americans.
Yes. Otherwise, you go to slave rolls and you look at Tom Slave, age 13. You'll see Bob, age 31. Mulatto, and oh my God, you can get really upset when you see, because they had that kind of thing in slave rows to fit into miscegenation. So you would find in Greene County, probably in your county, and all the counties that African Americans have been in this society, those kind of slave rows where they're divvied off as black, quadroons, octoroons, mulatto, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. But there is no last name. Most of the last names we have as slave descendants, slaves assume their last master's role in the first census that we were fully enumerated in.
Right, right. So now from South Carolina, I understand from you that the slaves were distributed all through the basically Confederate states, Alabama, Mississippi,
yes.
Georgia.
Right. right, because, Mr. Brooks, you remember that the 13 original colonies ended at Georgia, and western territories and states and what have you started at Alabama. So all of those areas, Alabama, Mississippi, Louisiana, East Texas, Arkansas, Tennessee, and all of those places were populated with slaves by those generals who had these massive number of slaves given to them and land. And you had this whole system of other people who eventually moved in, bought slaves, that are overseers. For instance, Greene County today, my home county, is 80% black. 80% black. And I would surmise that your county, which is in the black belt, has a similar kind of demographics. But they,
exactly,
they were brought in to work free. In fact, they established in Wilcox County, which is, you know, is next to Montgomery in Lyons County, one of the largest slave plantations sort of east of the Mississippi River. And their descendants of those people exist today. I know some of them in Selma and Dallas County because my wife's family is from Selma.
Oh, okay, okay. So as far as finding out about a person's genealogy, I it seems like that's a lot easier nowadays than it was, say, 30 or 40 years ago.
It is, because a lot of the information is now on the Internet. You have Ancestry.com. You have genealogy.com, and of course, even on the website is the African DNA website called AfricanAncestry.com. I personally know Dr. Gina Page. Gina Page finished Stanford out here. She is not a physician doctor, but she is a PhD in economics. But Dr. Kittles, K-I-T-T-L-E-S, is an MB. He wanted to know where he was from, because, as I said, it's easy to run into a dead end with the 1880 census. And yet, DNA-wise, some of us, ancestor-wise, have been in this country since 1619. But the documents are not there for us to see. It's always surmised that those who were some of the academicians in my extended family said that there were, they knew that there were certain people among the predominant population who had this information, but they would not give it to us because we would do what? Find a lineage to them for slavery and sue them individually for reparations. So they
right.
had they
right,
knew
right.
who their families owned. I always
yes.
felt when I grew up that there were whites around me in Greene County who knew exactly who had brought my ancestors into Greene County on both sides of my family. But they have never made any attempt to inform us.
Okay. Let me just interrupt just for a second to let everybody know that you're listening to the Council of Elders talk show. My name is Jansen Brooks. And we're talking today with Dr. Sam McAlpine. And if you have, if you'd like to make questions or comments, please press the number one. So, so you think that one of the reasons why that we weren't informed, Dr. McAlpine, is because they thought that we would want reparations?
I think that's one of them. And the other thing might be some of them might be embarrassed, you know.
Oh, might be embarrassed.
might be embarrassed. But money is always a big issue. After all, you know, the whole concept of the Civil War was the South had all of this labor and was very wealthy. And the North, there were slaves in the North, but they don't have the topography you have for growing these kinds of crops that you do in the South, especially the Southeast. So And what you look at it is one emancipation came five at the end of the Civil War. We had a Reconstruction that lasted until 1877. And you, if you have read some of the history of reading, Ulysses S. Grant, the president, he tried so hard to help the advancement of free slaves, but he couldn't. So Rutherford B. Hayes in 1877, when he was elected president, by capitulating things to white sovereignness, he allowed them to initiate Jim Crow. So in 1877, Reconstruction ended, and we went into Jim Crow until 1965, really, 1970, before they finally took some of the signs down. At least I remember in West Alabama, their laws had passed, but they still had the signs up, and you still were directed to the back door, you see. And most people don't realize there never was an official law from the federal government for Jim Crow. The South initiated it themselves, because Rutherford B. Hayes wanted the backing and the support of white sovereignty in the Senate, in the Congress. You said during the Reconstruction, because states like Mississippi and Louisiana were predominantly black, you had governors and senators and congressmen from those states. But with Jim Crow, the violence, the Klan, and all of this, they killed all that. So we went with Jim Crow for about almost 100 years. To me, that's neo-slavery. I felt that I was born in neo-slavery. I was born in
1949. Okay. So let me just clarify for everyone that's listening. You mentioned three websites where you could do some genealogy research: Ancestry.com, Genealogy.com. And the third one was, I believe, AfricanAncestry.com, was it?
Yes, that is if you're willing to defray the cost of them doing your DNA, because they'll send you out a secure test kit. You scrape the cheeks, they'll get your cells, their culture, and then they get your DNA. And there is a database, and this database was created eons ago, when they really started doing a lot of DNA at Howard University, which you know is one of our foremost universities, sent clinicians to West and Central Africa, which is where most of slaves were taken from. And they created a database by getting samples from pure identified tribal people. So there is a database, and most of the time, 99.9% of the time, they can tell you what tribes you have DNA and what modern-day country that is.
Right. Let me ask you this question. I mean, when the slaves came to America from one tribe or another, I mean, they were so mixed. I mean, how could you... I mean,
absolutely. Because what happens is there are genetic markers. So you might get back something that says on your mitochondrial DNA of your mother that you have a hit of 20% for Senegal, a hit of 20% for Gabon, a hit of 20% for the Cameroon. Some people get back where they are 100%. Igbo, Nigeria. We had in my extended family, one of my uncle's wives, the identical twins, and they wanted to know where they were from. My gift to them and their children, who asked me, because I'm one of the few physicians in the family, to do their DNA, and I did their DNA. It came back to 100% Igbo from Nigeria. So sure, the master didn't care what country you came from. Some people were chosen to breed. So there are a lot of us who, you have your multi-country, multi-tribal. They can tell you that.
Right, yeah. Right. So it will come back, you were 100% one thing or 20% something. And so it was it would kind of give you a breakdown.
Yes, for me, my family, my
so,
dad's mother side of the family, Cameron,
so,
T-Car, Bamaliki, my mother, Mindy, Sierra,
Dr.
Nell,
McAlpine.
My dad's side of the family, Senator.
Dr. McAlpine, this is Oscar here, broadcast engineer. You know, I'm, as I listen to you, yes, I do understand that it used to be a time when it was difficult to find out what your ancestry was. And I'm a member of 23andMe, so I've researched a little bit about where my family tree got its roots buried and where it came from. But I know just enough to be dangerous about my real family. I do know that my great-great-great-grandfather was a traveling salesman. He came through the lower part of Georgia. He had a fling with one of the maids, what was our governor's name? No, I was thinking Governor Terminator in California. But Governor Terminator, and so that's where we got started. My great great grandfather was white, and so consequently, we all got some mixtures in it. But I do know that my sister has done some research on our family. And we what we know for sure is that we're mixed up pretty good, and I'm impressed with your general. I'm impressed with your general knowledge of your family tree, and how it relates to what you think and where you're from. So thank you so much for your research, and thank you so much for being a guest on the show today. I will back out now and let Mr. Jensen take over.
Okay. So I know that a lot of folks are starting to wonder about their ancestry and how to do research on it. And it's good to have, because generations from now, our descendants can look back on it and piggyback on some of the work that we've already done. And by that time, it'll probably be even easier. But Dr. McAlpine, for a little while, let's talk about some of your medical career. You worked quite a bit with the VA, I understand.
Yeah, I went to the VA. My dad had colon cancer. And in 1996, we still live rural. My mom, when my dad was not a small man, so he needed some help. So I took my two sons, and we went from, I was working in Los Angeles for United Healthcare, Watch Health Foundation, and we went there to help and assist him, and assist them. And while I was there, within about 90 days, he expired. So, my kids were still children, teenagers. Except for my oldest son was old enough. I put him at Alabama there in Tuscaloosa. And the youngest, I decided to go work for the VA because, as you very well know, health insurance is very expensive. And I needed benefits and what have you. So I started out with the historic Tuskegee VA, doing internal medicine and rheumatology, which I trained for. And, of course, this is one of the original VAs that was actually designated by Abraham Lincoln. Slaves who had fought in the Civil War. And some of those buildings still stand there. So that's why I started it. But after my dad left, I died. Eventually, after sitting in a year there, I returned to my home out west. And I also worked at the federal hospital in Las Vegas because they needed internal medicine doctors. And, the hospital there was one of the first built for active duty and VA. And then they opened up Mesa as a VA around 99, and they needed and they were looking for internal medicine trained doctors to come help them with primary care and some specialty. So that's how I got to Sacramento 20 years ago. And, of course, you know, they have a massive VA out at Travis Air Force Base, and that's where I was until I looked up and I had become pretty old and old enough to retire. I took a retirement last December.
Okay. So how did you find working with the VA?
Well, it's pretty arduous work. You know, the VA has a very large patient population, a very large patient population, and some of them might be some veterans online. I'm not trying to offend anyone, but part of the process, once, you know, the VA used to be that they would only see those veterans in primary care who had a documented service-connected disability. But they opened it up to all honorably discharged veterans several years ago. So they have a massive patient population. So primary care is very big in the VA, and with it comes some of the encumbrances that you see with any large government organization. I think you know what I mean. So
right.
You have a lot of people in management who were former veterans. Probably the greatest contingent of people who are not veterans would be among the doctors and nurses. So there could be some cultural problem so far as that. But I can tell you that once you get into the system of the VA, they have world-class trained doctors and nurses. So the care can be excellent. You'll find very few people who will leave the VA because they feel that they have been maltreated or what have you. And that is the problem for the VA. They have a lot of patients. And especially with the pandemic and also with, you know, like you go back to 2007, 2008, when we had that great recession, a lot of people lost their jobs. So in come a big contingent of people into the VA, which means that staffing could be a problem. So that's what you would see, like with any large healthcare organization. I think that even if you have Kaiser, you find out that Kaiser might give you 15 minutes for a follow-up visit in primary care. The VA still will give a patient 30 minutes for a follow-up and an hour for a new appointment.
Dr. McAvoy, Oscar's here.
Yeah.
Two quick questions. I'm not sure whether you said it and I missed it, but the first question is, what is your specialty? I know that you work for the VA.
I was trained in internal medicine and rheumatology.
Okay. And the second question is, and this is for the youth that might be listening, what kind of advice would you give for young people who would like to follow you in your footsteps? You obviously have some large shoes to fill. And so there are many youth out there who are looking to try to find themselves. And I suspect that medicine might be one of the things that people who are trying to find themselves might be interested in following you on. So what kind of advice would you give to kids who are thinking about going into that direction?
The first thing is motivation. Try to be the best student you can be. We all come from environments that dictate what we have access to. I'm from a rural environment. I went to a county high school that they call Green County Training School. All of our county schools for the rural area were always a training. That was always a high school. But no matter where you are, get all you can, because in that I came from a segregated environment, it means that I had an advantage in terms of the people who taught me being interested in me and pushing me and pulling things out of me and serving as role model. So in essence, I know in an environment like here where most of probably the teachers that a lot of our kids see here don't necessarily look like us, but you got to try to get from them all you can and stay away from those who might dissuade you from seeking something higher than being somebody that, you know, works in a more working class environment. Because you'd be surprised at how some kids are dissuaded by other populations of people as saying, well, you're not from the right family, you don't have any money. We didn't have any money. But what I knew is that there were grants, there were loans, and there were also organizations looking to give to promising minority students. There are all kinds of scholarships online that you can apply for. Your school counselor can help you. But the main thing is you got to have motivation, because you still got to have the grades. You got to have the grades. You don't have to go to college and be a doctor and major in pre-med. You can major in liberal arts and enjoy your English, enjoy your literature, and enjoy this. But you got to have requisite hours of math, science, and physics. You can sort of have those even as your elective. I have a nephew who did that at the University of Alabama, and he majored in African-American studies. It doesn't be that you got to put your nose to the grind and say, I'm going to major in pre-med, where I'm going to be taking all of these courses in my head is just throbbing at night, I'm up and what have you. You can have some fun in terms of, I majored in zoology and chemistry and what have you, but I'm just going to say, you don't have to do that. I did not know that at the time. This is in the 60s, but now I know that. When I got to medical school, there were people who had majored in French literature, but they have taken their 40 hours of hard sciences and physics, what have you. And then what you do is make sure that you can find a mentor. There are people out there that you can go to, and your school counselor should know that you can go to this physician's office or somebody that looks like you or who doesn't look like you but have an interest in being fair to teach you how what the steps are for taking the medical college admission test.
Okay, this is Oscar. Let me break in right quick. Last time, you're listening to the Council of Elders show with Dr. Samuel McAlpine, our special guest, and Brother Jansen Brooks. And so we would like for you to know that if you would like to make a comment or ask a question of this distinguished gentleman, press 1 on your phone, and we will be glad to let you in. But this is a very interesting subject, Dr. McAlpine, so please continue.
Yes. And the other thing is that some children might not want to be a physician or a dentist. That's fine, because there are several allied health fields where you have to still have an abundance of medical order to perform, i.e., some people decide that they only want to do two years of medical school. You can become a physician assistant. They have their own board certification process. Some people decide that they are an RN, but they want to be a clinical RN. It is 2 years of training and obtain a master's degree. You become a nurse practitioner. So you don't have to just be very, very rigid to physician, internship, residency, fellowship, and blah, blah, blah. There are alternatives. There are some people out there who decide to be an occupational therapist. Occupational therapists, these are people who deal with stroke rehab, an upper extremity rehabilitation for your severe arthritics or people who have had accidents, et cetera, versus a physical therapist, which is also a field of medicine where you deal with rehabilitation of lower extremities and people who have had hip replacement, knee replacement, ankle replacement, arm, shoulder replacement, that kind of thing. You also can have different people who want to be in other fields of nursing, where people become nurse educators for diabetes, something that ravages us as a people. If you were to ask me, Sam McAlpine, who's one person on dialysis in America, I would tell you it is a black American, and we are 50% of people on hemodialysis in this country. And it's primarily from what? Poorly controlled, managed hypertension of diabetes that has killed our kidney? Other questions for me?
Okay, so, yeah, I like you mentioning that there's a whole range of fields in the medical profession. You will usually think of doctors or nurses, but you broadening out now, that's you don't have to be necessarily a doctor or a dentist.
Right.
So
we would hope that you want to, but if you desire not to, we wouldn't turn you away from the medical field because there are allied health professionals.
Oh, okay. I also like what you said about get away from people who try to dissuade you, because a lot of times kids can have dreams of being, doctor or whatever they have it, and there are people that will try to lower their expectations. And so you're saying that you need to kind of avoid those kind of people.
Yes, Mr. Brooks, in my family, or my dad's family, very large. My father had a contingent in his family that ever since emancipation, some of those people in his extended family had become educated, school teachers. Some of them were physicians that finished in Harvard back in the 40s. They, to a certain extent, when they found out, for instance, that I was going to medical school, they made a purchase of calling my mother and father to tell them, oh, he's obtained a baccalaureate degree. That's more than any that you have. He needs to come on out and try and help you. So you don't have to listen to those people either, because there are resources out there, if you are poor as I was, to get you into a credible, competitive medical school, residency, fellowship, et cetera. It's out there. But you've got to be able to take advantage of it, which means that you've got to be motivated, have the grades, get the board scores, and just be motivated. Motivation is the main thing. And never let anybody dissuade you.
Right. Motivation is the main thing. You got to have the grades. And I would imagine you got to have the right attitude as well.
Yes. You got to have the right attitude, which is positive, and you got to let some people help you, because there are people who can serve as role models or mentors and can tell you how to get where it is you wish to go. I told you, I was at Alabama A&M. I was looking at Vietnam service. And Alice Jenkins, I think you heard me tell you, Alice Jenkins was this little black lady who had finished historically Talladega College, which, is very good undergraduate school. This woman was so smart until she got into Cornell University, which, is Ivy League. And she was the first black woman in this country to obtain a PhD in the life sciences from Cornell University. Well, when I was at Alabama A&M, she was my mentor. She took me under her wings. And she told me, she says, you're bright. You have good grades. She said, because I taught you. She says, you can go to medical school. I said, medical school? I said, I don't have any money. I said, my parents have no money. She says, I can get you resources. That's what I'm talking about.
Right. Obviously, you impressed her, with your studies and your mindset. So she was able to feel confident in pushing you along.
Right. I don't know whether she was still there when you arrived, but you might have heard of the great Alice Jenkins. She was known to be the worst, in terms of grading in the life sciences. She was over the section in biology. And she told me, she said, I know what kind of scores you made on the test. You could mix it in anybody's medical school, because she said, I know how I am. That's what she told me.
Okay. Tell us a little bit about the exam that you have to take in order to get into medical school.
Yeah, it's called Medical College Admission test, medical college admission test, MCAT, M-C-A-T. Any of the kids listening can go online and do an internet search. It will tell you it has a verbal component and a math component to it. And, you know, in order to be looked at by a medical school, you've got to at least score in the 50th percentile. If you score, you know, 75th percentile, 98th percentile, you're going to be accepted by some of the most prestigious medical schools with a lot of money. I have taught some students at Sac County. When I was at the VA, I would go to Sac County in the evening to help them with their internal medicine and specialty care. And one of the kids who used to come every evening with me as her mentor, I can remember her. She scored 94% on the MCAT by coming in and just talking every evening and me helping her out to what to look for, seeing patients with others and what have you. So it can happen. It's out. You don't have to feel that you cannot achieve something and you do it because
yes.
You might say something nasty.
We got just over 8 minutes left of showtime, but we have a guest who would like to make a comment or ask a question. Can I let him in?
Oh, good morning. This is Amos Holtz.
Good morning, caller.
And
you're live on the Council of Elders show. Please state your name, where you're calling from. When you ask your question or make your comment, please mute your phone.
Good morning. My name is Amos Holtz, and I am calling. I have been listening, and certainly several questions have come to mind. And yes, I'm not a teenager, and I'm not a young person. I've experienced some of life. And my question would be directed toward the doctor in regards to one's attitude, one's motivation, and more specifically, was your desire for the prestige and the financial that's associated with medicine, was it specifically to look into trying to see what it is that you could do to help mankind?
Yes.
Thank you, and I'll wait for your answer.
Yes, I have no money. First of all, I want to make sure you understand that. A little bit of retirement through the VA, small 401k. I never thought of prestige. Growing up in rural West Alabama, I had seen multiple diseases on my mother's side and my dad's side. And I had seen the lack of access to care. If you're going through somebody's back door, they're not going to exactly treat you as they treat the person who comes through the front door. I saw that. One of the things on my dad's side of the family was connective tissue disease, lupus, scleroderma, rheumatoid arthritis. I didn't understand it. These people could not get that kind of health care. We live 9 miles from Birmingham. And that's where the University of Alabama was that had the few specialties that existed in the state. So I desired to learn all I could about those diseases because later on in life, my father became a rheumatoid. I have 3 siblings who are rheumatoids, and my oldest son has a vasculitis. So it's true, Dr. Jenkins helped me get into medical school, but what it did was, it fulfilled my desire to learn something where I could understand all these exotic diseases that I had seen from a child. I drive a Ford Focus. I'm a far cry from a flashy car, and I don't live in some palatial home. I live in Southside Park. So prestige and money has never been part of why I am as a physician. I have volunteered. I have been to Africa 5 times. I've worked in clinics in Ghana. I worked clinics in the Cameroon. I've worked in clinics in Senegal. I've worked in clinics for healthcare volunteers overseas in the island of about 200,000 Africans in the diaspora. They were slaves like us. The clinic is a dirt floor. The hospital is a hospital that was given to the St. Lucians in World War II because the United States built it to expatriate wounded veterans from the World War II theater. And they didn't like the island's politics, so they gave them this 500-bed hospital. I worked there. I worked at that hospital with residents and students from Loyola University in Chicago because it's a Jesuit order that helps the staff at that hospital and brings nurses and doctors come down there and teach them at Iowa and other Jesuit-related medical schools in this country. And we taking care of HIV-positive patients on an island where there was no antiretroviral drugs. So, no, I have not been a person running around in a Mercedes and all the rest of the stuff being exalted. I have dedicated myself even to the veterans who come to the VA hospital full time for their primary care or specialty care. They're working class or poor. So, no, my life has been dedicated to helping dispossess. I have gone home to Alabama twice and worked in federally funded clinics and a federally funded clinic and a hospital that we used to have in Selma, established by the fathers of St. Edmund for the black population because the patient was so vicious in Alabama, they wouldn't even let us in the back door. But no, that's being for prestige and money, that's not me.
Oh, yes. Well, Dr. Metcalf, I can tell that you're very passionate about medicine, and we're so happy that you took the time today to come on the show. I had to do sort of a coin toss as to what to talk to you about today, your medical career or your knowledge of African-American ancestry, and particularly Alabama slave trade in Charleston, South Carolina. And so we did touch on a little bit of both. And so anybody's listening, you've got some groundwork that you can start from. So we just thank you so much for coming on the show today.
Oh, you're very welcome, sir.
And let's see. As far as your final wrap up, anything that you would like to tell young people that's listening to in maybe 1 minute?
Right. I would like to say if you have a goal, stick with that goal. Find someone who will help you fulfill that goal. Stay out of trouble. As you heard me say, I did volunteer for 1 cent to serve as a chief physician for the medical hospital at Solano. And the thing that was most discouraging to me was that I believe that the black population of the state of California is a mere 6.2%. 40% of the people incarcerated at that medical hospital at Solano were black. So, you know, my advice is the same thing I said to my two sons, and now I say to my three grandsons who live in the house with us. Be careful, be stable. If it looks like trouble, it is trouble. Call somebody where we can come to get you out of it, because you got to have a resource to see how this country is. It's very easy for us to get into trouble. And that's
okay. If it looks like trouble, it is trouble.
Yes, sir.
Well, listen, we're gonna close it out with that.
Help me.
The show has officially closed. The show has officially ended. So it was a joy talking to you, sir. And so, Jansen, we will talk to you later.